Bible reading this morning is taken from Matthew chapter 5, verse 33 through 37. If you'd like to follow along in your pew Bible, it's on page 810, page 810. Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, "You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn. But I say unto you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is the footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil."
Good morning. Please have your Bibles open to Matthew 5, where Rich just read for us. As he said, if you're using one of the pew Bibles, that's on page 810. Matthew chapter 5, we are continuing a series. This is the third part in our series on the Sermon on the Mount. Before I get into that, one thing I didn't mention earlier, we announced it last week, and it was in last week's newsletter, but we're happy to share with all of you that a week ago Friday, I guess that would have been the 8th, Mitch Bishop was baptized into Christ, and Mitch is sitting here up front. The bad people sit on the back, the good people sit up front, and he's learned that very well already. Sorry to those of you on the back, I guess I should apologize, but no, we're very excited for Mitch. We're happy to have him with us. He was out of town last weekend, but we certainly look forward to many good things in years to come with our church family together. We do have a number of you who are visiting with us. We're blessed by your presence, and we are continuing a series on the Sermon on the Mount, the most famous of all sermons. And as I've said throughout this series, if you just take a moment out of each day, if you just took a moment one time a week, every week, to sit down and read Matthew chapters 5, 6, and 7, the sermon that changed everything in so many ways, that revolutionized the world, it changed the world, the time in which Jesus was living. But if you read it today, it should continue to change us as well. Our theme for 2016 for this congregation is All Things New. And Jesus is taking the old things that the world has been saying. He says, "You have heard that it was said." And back then, people were saying a lot of different things. And if you were a Jew, you had heard the law of Moses. You'd attended synagogue. You had grown up with a heritage of hearing certain things being said and taught based on that law. Sometimes you also heard certain things being said in the world as well. But Jesus says, all these things you have heard, I want us to revisit them and reevaluate them. And I want these things to mean even more today to you than they have ever meant. He says, I didn't come to abolish these things, I came to fulfill them. I came to give them new and deeper, a fulfilled meaning. You know, it's interesting, when Matthew records for us the Sermon on the Mount, at the very end of chapter 7, he gives us his own little commentary. Now, I don't know if Matthew was in the audience or not, but in so many words, Matthew says at the end of chapter 7 that the crowd, the assembly of people who heard Jesus deliver this message, they were amazed. They were astonished. Because Jesus taught as one having authority. That was really a commentary on the old ways and the old teachings of the establishment, the religious establishment of Jesus' day. But it also says so much about Jesus as well. He taught as one possessing this authority, something different than what they had ever heard. I wonder what it would have been like to be in that audience, to hear Jesus deliver this message for the very first time with fresh ears and fresh eyes. Yes, he was saying some things that you had heard, but he was turning those things on their head. Were the people so amazed and so astonished that they just sat there in stunned silence? I think for some that was probably true. But if there were others who maybe have my kind of personality, the kind who sort of needs to communicate and talk some things out, I figure some of us, if we were there, we would have been sitting there, maybe standing there, And maybe with your family or your friends or maybe a complete stranger, whoever you're beside in the audience, you might have been saying, am I hearing this right? Did he really just say what I think he said? And did he really mean that? Yeah, I heard what he said, but did he mean the words that he just spoke? Because, you know, sometimes, you know, these rabbis, these teachers, they might say one thing, but they really mean something else. Did he really mean that? Does he really expect people to live by this standard, this way of thinking, this way of living? It's amazing. I'm just not sure how real it is. Well, Jesus was speaking to reality. He was speaking to the real situation of his day and time. He was speaking to the real situation of every day and time, of the human condition, of the way we tend to think and act, even sometimes the way we feel towards one another. Up to this point, we've examined what Jesus had to say, really starting in verse 21. You have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not murder. He's going to say, yeah, but I don't want you to hold anger and hatred in your heart. That would have been a tough pill to swallow for people who had always been told and heard, you know, as long as you don't murder, that's okay. Last week we looked at what he says beginning in verse 27. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Yeah, you should not commit adultery. But Jesus is going to take the standard to a whole different plane. He says, if you look at another person, if you look at a woman with lust in your heart, he says, you're already committing adultery. I'm concerned about who you are, just not only what you do, not only the outward performance of things, not only a checklist mentality. I, serving on behalf of God, want to get to the very heart and nature of who you are. And people have said, does he really expect people to operate with this kind of mindset? As tough and challenging as those two teachings were, I think as he gets into the passages we're going to look at today, we're especially going to look at verses 33 through 42. And there's going to be more than one statement today where he says, you have heard that it was said, but I want to say to you something new. As difficult as taking you shall not murder to a new level and you shall not commit adultery to a new level, the things that he's going to say in this passage, I think if I was in the audience, I would have said, this is even harder than that stuff. It has to do with how we define justice. So much of what Jesus says, actually from the very beginning, he says, I haven't come to abolish the law. If you were a Jew living in the first century, if you think about it, you really had two laws that you were living under. Because you were a descendant of Abraham, you were a part of Israel as a nation, you had the law of Moses. This was something that people were still teaching and upholding and sometimes reinterpreting, but this was a law, this was a standard by which people were to live. But because of the Roman Empire, you had those laws as well. And so you really had two different laws that were always holding authority over you. Now, our situation today is a little bit different. We just have, as far as legally speaking, the laws of the United States of America. Of course, we have local laws and state laws, that kind of thing. But we just have one infrastructure, legally speaking. But as those who believe in God and His Word and followers of Jesus, some ways we can take this book and begin to view it in a similar way as those Jews of old viewed the law of Moses. And so maybe you can say we sort of have these two standards working as law over us as well. And with laws, there are things that are expected of us. There are things that are required of us. There are things sometimes that you can say that you deserve because it's written into a legal code. And these things, when you put them together, give you a sense, a style of justice. For the vast majority of people throughout all time, no matter what they believed in religiously, or no matter what nation or empire they lived under geographically, here's how we as human beings typically think about justice. What is the very least I have to do? Because I'm required to do it. What is the very least, what is the absolute minimum I have to do? And what is the absolute most I can get out of this? Now when you think about it, isn't that universally how people typically think? When it comes to laws? What is the absolute least I have to do? But what is the absolute most I can get out of something? That is what we have heard. And that is what people had heard and what people had practiced in Jesus' day and time. He gets into some specifics. And like so many other things in the Sermon on the Mount, the specifics, while historically and contextually might be a little bit different for a Jew living in the first century, these are so similar to things that dictate the way we think and operate today. Let's look at the first one. He says in verse 33, "Again, you have heard that it was said to those of old, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn.'" What is your style of honesty? Point number one, what is your style of honesty? What does it mean to be honest? The justice of honesty. You know, we have things today that keep us honest from a legal perspective. If you are called to testify or really to serve as any part of a legal proceeding, you will be asked to take an oath, to sometimes maybe swear or at least affirm. Our laws really are rather accommodating for people whose religious beliefs say, "Well, I can't, you know, I can't swear on a Bible and I can't do this." And by the way, I did talk some about this passage in a different series a little over a year ago, and so I'm not going to repeat everything I said about that. But I don't think Jesus is inherently saying it is wrong to, you know, swear on a Bible or say, you know, "I promise to do this," or "I've got to sign my name on a contract." I don't think he's saying that is inherently evil. What Jesus is getting at is, how do you define or what dictates honesty in your life? And in their day and time, people had the mindset, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not swear falsely, but shall perform to the Lord what you have sworn.'" And that means if I say I swear to the Lord, I swear to God, I'm going to do this, or I'm going to do this by Jerusalem, or by this, or by that, I am being recognized by God. Hey, if I do something before God, guess what? I better perform. I better owe up. I better follow through, because I stand before the Lord. I answer to Him. And that's big stuff. That means we're getting serious about being honest. That's the problem, isn't it? When we have to do something different and unique to get serious about honesty. Jesus says, "I've got something better for you. I say to you, do not take an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is the throne of God, or by earth, for it is His footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. And do not take an oath by your head, for you cannot make one hair white or black. Let what you say be simply yes or no. Anything more than this comes from evil." And the people have said, "What? What?" You know, if I swear to God by something, or if I stand in a courtroom tomorrow and I put my hand on a Bible, or I make an oath saying I'm being recognized by the courts and the laws of this land that I'm being honest, you know what they can do in the United States today if I'm not being honest? I can be found guilty of perjury. Well, that's pretty big stuff. And back then, if I swore something by God or something that belonged to Him, that would have seen as big stuff. But here's Jesus' point. Do you need the law to keep you honest? And if you do, that's pretty sad. Our sense of justice needs to be more than just, you know, you need to take me seriously if I tell you I'm going to swear by my firstborn. If I tell you, listen, on my mama's grave, I'm telling you the truth. Well, you know what? I shouldn't need my mom's grave to tell you the truth. I should just be able to tell you the truth. And if I'm telling you the truth like that at all times, and you're telling me the truth like that at all times, isn't that a greater sense of justice for everybody? What's what? Fair's fair. Right's right. We're not playing games. We're not doing the fine print of life, looking for the loophole, or redefining our words, putting spin on it. And yeah, when I say something like that, a lot of people think about politics, but don't we do that in everyday relationships? You know, I say something to somebody, and they come back later and say, Blaine, do you remember when you said that? Well, I didn't really mean it like that. Yeah, you could have taken it that way, but, you know, that's not what I really mean. You should have known better than that. Or we're intentionally vague so that we can get out of something. Or we don't commit to things so that we can renege on promises. Jesus says, let your yes be yes. Let what you say actually mean what you say. And let your no be no. Anything other than this, that is the beginning of evil. You've heard these things said. I want to say something different to you about what it means to be honest. He moves on from that, is going to continue to up the standard. In verse 38, he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Whew. This is one of those passages that ever since Jesus said it, people are saying, did he really mean that? There's no way Jesus could have meant what he actually was saying. And so sometimes we spend more time talking about what Jesus didn't say than actually what he did say. But here's what Jesus is talking about. The justice of peace. Just like the justice of honesty, the justice of peace. So many times in life when we, again, humans throughout all time, throughout all the world, when we are wronged, when somebody slights us, when somebody insults us, what do we want to do? We got to get them back. We've got to get revenge. Because that's fair. That's just. And when I want justice for myself, again, what is the maximum I can get out of this? Well, when the law of Moses was being written, people were very guilty of seeking the absolute maximum they could get out of somebody for being slighted. And so, you know, if Barry would wrong me, let's say if Barry would steal one of my cows, I would take the law into my own hands. Depending on my mood and my temperament, you know, I'd say, well, he stole one of my cows. I'm going to take two of his. Or worse, you know, I just don't like Barry. I might take care of Barry myself because he wronged me. Well, when the law of Moses was being codified, there was a sense of justice that was built into it. And it said, you know, if Barry takes Blaine's cow, the absolute maximum that is fair and right for Blaine to get out of this is get one of Barry's cows back in return. Or Barry, if he doesn't have any cows, you know, he financially substitutes for that in a way that's fair and right. And so the law of Moses in a lot of ways was seeking a sense of justice and peace to keep people from going way too far with their sense of revenge and justice, both personally and for the whole nation. So, you know, you take my eye out, I take your eye out, that kind of thing. Tooth, tooth, all right, all's fair, account settled. But you know what? It just doesn't work that way, does it? That kind of mindset never serves humanity very well. Yes, there needs to be a sense of justice in our criminal justice system. But I believe Jesus is especially talking about when you've personally been wronged or slighted in some way. Some of you have lived in eastern Kentucky and southwestern West Virginia. Hatfields and McCoys. That worked out really well for both parties, didn't it? No. I mean, you know, these days we turn it into a show down in Pigeon Forge and we sort of laugh and chuckle about it. But if you would have been living back then, how tragic, how pathetic, how sad that was. Because as soon as one family did one thing, the other family had to do something back. But they had to make the other side really feel the pain and feel that sense of loss. And so sometimes they were upping the ante. And sometimes it was just sort of tit for tat kind of thing. You think about modern day gangs, or gangs really throughout all of history. One gang does something to one side. Hey, the other one, we got to do something that we believe is equal, is fair, is just. We've got to get the most out of this situation. Israel, the Palestinians, same situation. People wonder, when's there going to be peace in the Middle East? It's become a joke. Well, there won't be peace in the Middle East until somebody decides, until both parties decide, we're going to have a different standard of justice. That we seek peace. That when somebody wrongs or hurts or insults me, do I have to get revenge before I have peace within myself? And if I do, what kind of life am I really living? What good is there in that? You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who is evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And then the third sense of justice, style of justice that Jesus addresses here begins in verse 40. He says, and if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Here Jesus is talking about the justice of grace. Giving or doing more than what is required of you, or more than what would be expected. And just like the other things, as Jesus said this, I figure the crowd was saying, does he really mean what he's saying? Does he not understand the Pandora's box of issues he is about to open? And I have more to say about that in a moment. It's interesting that in verse 40, he says, if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. He's speaking to Jews who lived under the law of Moses. If you want to, you can turn briefly back to Exodus chapter 22. Because in Exodus 22, within the law of Moses, there was a sense of justice in which Moses, God, was protecting and making sure people weren't being put in such a situation that was depriving them of the very basics of life. When a situation might arise when somebody owed somebody something. In Exodus chapter 22, and this is to some degree talk about maybe somebody suing you, or you suing somebody else. Exodus 22 verse 26, he says, if ever you take your neighbor's cloak in pledge, you shall return it to him before the sun goes down. For that is his only covering, and it is his cloak for his body. In what else shall he sleep? And if he cries to me, I will hear, for I am compassionate. Now here in the law of Moses, what Moses is saying is, hey, listen, if somebody's just down to their one covering, says you can't take that from them. You might be able to hold it as a pledge for a day, but when nighttime comes and it gets cold, you give it back to that person because that's all that they've got. Well, here in Matthew chapter 5, the example Jesus gives is somebody is suing me. And they've taken maybe my outer garment. And I could say by the law of Moses, hey, you might be able to have that as long as the sun's up, but as soon as the sun goes down, I deserve to get that back. By the law, I deserve to have this article of clothing. That's only what is right. That is what is just. Jesus says, yeah. I want to challenge you to something else. You know that person who sued you for that outer garment? Go ahead and give them your inner one as well. What are you talking about, Jesus? You don't know the law of Moses. They don't have the right to do that. I've got to look out for me. Jesus gives another example that people in his day and time would have been familiar with. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Now, this isn't about the law of Moses. This is about the Roman Empire. In the Roman Empire, a soldier could compel you because of their authority and the one that they represent. If I was walking down the road one day and they said, you know, Blaine, we need you to carry this load for 1 mile to help us out as the Roman Empire. As representatives of the Roman Empire, you are being compelled to carry this load, to carry this burden, to help us out with this work for 1 mile. What would we have thought, or how would we have responded? Well, this is what I have to do. This is the law of the land. And so here I would have started my journey. I would have taken the load that the soldier has compelled me to carry, and I would have walked in. You know, their measurements were a little bit different, but let's say there's 5,280 feet in a mile. So here I'm going to count them out. And when I get to 5,280, you know what I'm going to do? Boom. Why? That's all that you can require me to do. That's the absolute least that's asked of me by the law. Jesus says, let's go to. Jesus, that's not what the law requires. Doesn't Jesus know what he's talking about? Yeah, he does. He's talking about grace. He summarizes it in verse 42. Give to the one who begs from you, and do not refuse the one who would borrow from you. Be a giving, a gracious, a generous person. So often throughout human history, when it comes to generosity, we think, you know, what's the absolute least I have to do to look generous? What's the very least I have to do according to, maybe for them, the law of Moses? What's the very least I have to do for us today according to the New Testament to be seen as a generous and kind and gracious person? Well, Jesus says, if you ask me to go 1 mile, I guess now I've got to go 2 miles. So I've got to do 5,280 times 2. And when I get to that exact point, I can stop. Because that's what Jesus requires. That's the new law. No, that's not what Jesus is saying. You see, our problem sometimes with reading Jesus' words was the same problem that the Jews had with reading the law of Moses. They thought about their law, and sometimes we think about the Bible and Jesus' words as law in such a way that we say, what is the very least I have to do? Or what's the very most I can get out of this situation? Jesus says, I want you to turn and change that thinking completely. I want you to be a person of grace. A person who extends yourself. Who sees how you can be used for the benefit and blessing to another. Now, this is where people look at this and say, well, this couldn't be what Jesus means, because they take this in some ways too literally. I'll give you an example. I'm not going to go into too many details, but most of you can probably understand where I'm going with this. When I was a teenager at the church camp where I grew up, there was a young preacher, and he came and taught our Bible class one day at church camp. And this was the passage he was teaching. And he was especially looking at verse 39. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. His understanding of that passage is, you know, Jesus is setting a new law for us. If anybody's going to hit your right cheek, turn and give them the other. After they hit that one, if they want to hit your right cheek again, keep turning and turning. He took it to the level that even if somebody wanted to harm my wife, my children, he says, that's what you have to do because that's what Jesus said. Folks, that's not what Jesus is saying. Jesus is not opening us up to becoming enslaved to wicked people. None whatsoever. By the way, when I was 13 or however old I was at the time, I pretty much told that guy, that's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard. And if he was here today, I'd probably have even stronger language than that. But so many times, people read this like it's a legalistic code. And if this is what Jesus says, this is exactly what it means. Well, Jesus did mean what he said. He's not opening us up to the enslavement to wicked people. But you know what else? He wants to make sure we're not enslaved to the law. We're not enslaved to a way of thinking that says, what is the absolute least I have to do? And what is the absolute most I can get out of this situation? Instead, Jesus wants us to live a life of freedom. Because when you live with a legalistic way of thinking, you know what? You are being confined by the very thing that you think should be liberating you. And that's why a lot of people today are tired and bitter towards religion. Because they look at this and they say, I have to go 2 miles no matter what anybody asks of me? No. Jesus encourages discernment and common sense and wisdom. But he also encourages grace. That when you have an opportunity to serve, to give, to be generous, that you have an open heart, not a closed heart or a closed mind. Ultimately, this passage is about freedom versus confinement. In the next few slides as we close, I just want to make some applications of really what Jesus is getting at here. The first slide here, freedom versus confinement. In talking about oaths and talking about honesty, if I need an oath to keep me honest, I am living in confinement. Think about that. If I need to swear by something or affirm for you, if I have to double down on my word for you to think I'm honest, I'm really the one who's living a confined life. But if I live with transparency, where my yes is a yes and my no is a no, guess what? I'm free. There's ultimate freedom in that kind of transparency. Number two, freedom versus confinement. In talking about us being slapped on one cheek, what's Jesus really getting at? If I need to avenge every insult and loss in life, every time you wrong me, if I have to get you back, sucker, before life is good again, I'm living in confinement. That's a horrible way to live. You wrong me, I can't be free again until I wrong you back. But guess what? If I live with grace, if I live with forgiveness, I am free. If I say, you know what? Rich, he might have wronged me this past week. Whether it was intentional or not, you know, in some ways that's between him and God. But I don't have to get him back. I don't have to have an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Because I'm living with freedom. And then finally, freedom versus confinement. If I seek the bare minimum of the law, the very least that I have to do, I'm living in confinement. That can be true of the laws of land. What's the very least I have to do to be a good citizen? That's a pretty pitiful way to think about life. But let's think about living in the kingdom, being a child of God's. You know, sometimes somebody in my position, people will say, well, do I have to do this? No, you don't have to do anything. A have-to mentality when it comes to our relationship with the Lord or our relationship with our fellow man, there's nothing free in that. It's confining. It's exhausting. It's draining. But if I live with an open heart, if I extend myself to others, if I am generous and kind and looking for ways to help, giving not just my outer garment, but my inner one, and not expecting to be compensated in return, that's where real freedom exists. Final two slides. Just got two questions for you. Do I live by the law? A lot of people could answer that and say yes. But there's something more important. Do I live beyond the law? Living beyond the law is where real freedom exists. If you were a Jew listening to this sermon of Jesus, you would say, he doesn't know the law at all. Jesus says, I know the law so well, I'm fulfilling it through these very words. Because I'm calling you to a new standard, but it's not a standard that you can say is etched on a tablet, that's written in a constitution, or even, and don't misunderstand me here, or even that is written within this book right here. If you look at this book and just say, what is the very least I have to do according to this book? That is a life of confinement. But what's the most I can give of myself to live a real life of freedom in the Lord. That's what this is all about. If you want that freedom this morning, I hope as you read the words of Jesus, you are just as impressed as that initial audience was 2,000 years ago. And the reason why they were impressed, and the reason why he spoke the way he did, was because he knew God better than anyone else. And he knew God's will better than anyone else. And he knew it so well that he was willing to live out these principles to where he went to the cross. And you talk about extending yourself with an open heart and with grace and with every ounce of love that could ever exist in the whole world. Jesus took these teachings to the cross to die for our sins. And if we haven't been touched or responded to that, but we believe that he did that for us, and we believe that he rose from the grave, we need to come to him and we need to follow him. This morning you can start that journey by putting him on. If you need to do that, like Mitch did a little over a week ago, you can take one of these front seats, you can meet with the elders or me in the library afterwards, but we would love to tell you more about Jesus. For those of us who have put Jesus on, let us live by his new word and his new teachings. If you need help doing so, please come forward while we stand and sing.
Hope to be like thee, blessed redeemed.